This is the Backlog Battle Podcast, episode 206.
Tuned for Lean.
And welcome to another episode of the Backlog Battle Podcast. This is Alex.
And this is Daniel.
What's going on, man?
I'm feeling good. I just finished doing some yoga, feeling nice and flexible.
I have to do yoga for today. I've been really bad lately because I've been working really hard on this new video series that we debuted last week. Have you seen it yet?
Of course.
Yeah, so you want to talk about like what this is all about? Because I think we did talk about it about 2 or 3 weeks ago, but you know, I want to have you explain it.
Yeah, you're talking about the clips, right?
Yeah, of course.
So basically, we decided that what would be a neat thing to do for the podcast would be to take the news topics that we talk about and we spin them off as their own videos. Now, they're still the same conversations as they are in the podcast, but now they're their own individual videos with some nice visuals, some gameplay if we're talking about like a specific game. And I think it's a great way to not only be able to get a piece of the podcast without having to watch the whole thing, but this way we're able to get the news out to you faster. One of the drawbacks of the podcast is that because it releases a week late, that most of the news is already a week old. This way, that won't be the case. This way, it will be much more relevant. It'll be almost right when it happens. So that way, you'll be able to hear our thoughts on something only maybe a day or two after the news drops. And I think in that way, people will be able to latch on to the content, and it'll still be fresh in your minds. And as opposed to like, oh yeah, that was that thing that happened last week, I guess, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And what's really cool about these is that, you know, one of the things that we were doing in with these videos is that in addition to kind of, you know, having the same conversation on the podcast, we actually add some other kind of facts as well. Like, so for example, when we were talking about you know, like Cyberpunk 2077, it actually, you know, I actually gave you a little bit of you know, information about, you know, CD Projekt Red and why, you know, like they had like really deep ties with BioWare, for example. So, you know, there's like Texas Scrolls that basically says like, yeah, actually, if you look at the history of CD Projekt and stuff, they actually published a lot of other people's games like Sega and Microsoft to Poland, you know? So it's kind of like this very interesting, you know, kind of informational video in addition to like a discussion about the news article. So it's really, really cool. And I think you guys will really enjoy it and stuff. And like what Daniel said, these come out actually generally like speaking like, you know, starting from the podcast that we record today, which is whenever this, you know, podcast comes out, whenever this episode comes out, we're gonna actually be releasing you know, the news articles that we talk about for next week's podcast, you know. So am I being clear here? I feel like I'm kind of muddling the, you know, the idea
here. Nah, you're fine, don't worry about it. You're beautiful.
Yeah, so basically that's what we're saying. So the news you'd hear about on the podcast next week, you're going to be seeing that on the YouTube channel sooner. You know, it'll be coming out like, you know, Thursday, Tuesday, and of course Wednesday of the following week when the actual episode comes out. So I think it's a good thing. You guys should check it out. It's on youtube.com/mybacklogbattle. Yeah, you guys enjoy that. And hopefully we see your comments on that because those are really important as well. So
yes, we want your feedback. Please let us know.
Yeah,
we want to hear all of your thoughts.
Yes, we'd like to make it better as well. So we actually got some really good feedback about that too. So you've been teasing this mystery game that I'm really kind of interested in hearing what the hell this is. Because this isn't like Dynasty Warriors, is it?
No, of course not.
Okay. I mean, you did say Dynasty Warriors 9 is like one of your most anticipated games of 2018. I had to,
again,
to ask that.
Hey, that's because I see it as an oddity, okay?
Okay. All right.
Come on.
So what the hell is this?
Do you remember Telltale's The Walking Dead?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not going to say I played through it, because you don't really play those games. I got through season 3, okay. The New Frontier.
Mm-hmm.
Did you play that one?
No, but Anthony told me that it was actually a lot better than season 2.
Interesting. I'm going to say I disagree.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, just real quick. So I thought the first Walking Dead was pretty good. I thought it was interesting. And I think part of the reason why it made such a big splash was because it was so new and fresh. I think looking back on it, it still holds up. Like, I would still say it's pretty good. It's not quite like the greatness that I think some people make it out to be. I think The Wolf Among Us is better. I think it's better written. But okay. but Walking Dead season 1, still pretty good. Good stuff. Season 2 was super boring. Like, I barely even remember anything that happened in season 2. It was so forgettable. Did you play through season 2?
I played the first episode and was just completely turned off by what seemed and felt like torture porn for like a little kid. I did not like that at all.
Yeah, I understand that. It was, season 2 was pretty off-putting. And like, again, it was also just very forgettable. Like, the only things I can really remember are you play as Clementine, they have her do a bunch of stuff for some reason, which is really weird and contrived, that these adults had this kid do all this shit, and then a character you thought was dead comes back later, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's all I remember. It sucked.
Okay. So, New Frontier. Is it a new frontier, after all?
Of shit.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I guess that's a little too harsh. So I'll say like this, like episode 1 of The New Frontier was decent. Like, it wasn't great or anything, but it was okay, you know.
Okay.
It stars a new character. His name is Javier, and he what's actually like one of the better parts of it was that it flashed back before the, or not rather before, but like it flashed back to like the very beginning again of when everything went down, like when the Zambambo apocalypse happened.
Okay.
And you know, it's a scene where the main character Javier, he has some bad blood with his brother, and that's like made clear at the start, and then they're mourning the death of their father, and then his father's a zombie. Oh no!
I can already tell that just talking about this game is making you want to vomit.
So yeah, like here's the problem. First and foremost, Javier is not a character. He is a self insert for the player.
Okay, that's not a bad thing necessarily.
But he's so bland. There's like so nothing to him that, like, at least with Lee from the first Walking Dead game, like, he still felt like his own character. Like, he didn't feel like a complete self-insert. Like, while Javier, his only really defining characteristic is that he used to play baseball.
Okay. Wow.
I can't tell you anything else about him.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's definitely the definition of a self-insert.
Yeah. So, like I said, episode one, not too bad. Episode two is where things started to get dumb. So episode two, it does this thing where, like, it just creates these really contrived conflicts just for the sake of them, and it's so bad. It also felt like really inconsistent. Like, characters would act like so irrationally. Like, I remember there was this one part where this older man was threatening Javier, the main character, and then Javier, he has like a kid it's actually his brother's kid, who got really fucking mad and put out a gun to the old man.
Wow.
Who's unarmed. He's an old man. He is unarmed. And just because he was like yelling at Javier, this fucking dumb kid was like that. Like, oh my fucking God.
Jesus Christ.
It's bad.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, a lot of the characters are also, like, really fucking annoying. Like, that kid, he is the fucking worst. Like, there was actually a point where I thought, like, oh, okay, maybe he's getting a little bit better. You know, he's talking about, like, oh, he wants to be a man like Javier is, you know. And I'm like, okay, that's nice. And then towards the end in, like, episode five, it was, like, one of those moments of, like, you know, oh, hold my beer as I, like, ruin everything.
Oh, my gosh. That's terrible, man.
Yeah. I just hated this.
I have to ask the question. What even possessed you to play these freaking games? I mean, it sounds like you just went through, like, you know, an apocalypse here or something like that. Something that
pun intended?
I see what you did there. Okay. Yeah, like, why?
I mean, I liked the first season. I thought it was good.
I mean, the second game, this would have been kind of like a Dragon Age situation where it's like, oh, look at this. Dragon Age 2 was crap. I don't know if I want to get Dragon Age Inquisition because that's 60 bones and might be crap, you know? And for the most part, it wasn't bad, but, you know, like, you get what I'm saying? It's like, it's the same situation with the Walking Dead series, I feel.
Well, to be fair, and I hid this a little bit. I actually didn't play the New Frontier. I watched a Let's Play. And let's be honest, is that really all that different from actually playing it?
I think so. I mean, a lot of people will argue, like, including yourself, that is it really, like, you know...
It's not the same, but when... Let's break down the interactivity in this game. You either do quick time events, which, whatever, or you make decisions that mean nothing.
I mean, I feel like saying that they mean nothing is an oversimplification of what's actually going on.
Oh, I would say in this game especially, your decisions mean nothing.
Okay.
There are several instances where you will quote unquote make a decision that either would have led to the same conclusion or the game did something to invalidate it in some way.
So what I'm hearing is that the illusion of choice is really bad. Like, not necessarily, like, that it doesn't make, you know, any sort of impact. I'm pretty sure it does. But I think just the kinds of decisions that you have to make don't feel impactful. Is that a better way to phrase it?
Sure. Like, because the first Walking Dead season one had decisions in it that in the moment felt like really impactful. And I think maybe part of that was, since it was the first time we played a game like this, that we weren't as savvy as to the, you know, the man behind the curtain, so to speak.
Sure.
But I would also argue that those moments, those decisions in general, just felt like they had more meaning to them. But a lot of the decisions in the New Frontier, by comparison, one, most of them aren't even interesting decisions to make. And two, you can tell based on that type of decision, you could predict how the game is going to invalidate it. Like, it wasn't as obvious in season one. In season three, you're already going like, oh, if I do this, then it doesn't matter because the game is obviously going to do this to make it so that the decision didn't really mean anything. Like, oh, you're going to kill this person now when I had a choice between these two, but you're going to just kill both anyways, right?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing.
I see. So it's almost like rudimentary choices and stuff. And yeah, okay. I get what you're where you're coming from. I do wonder, yeah, though, what'll happen if you do go back and play the first game. Because like you said, like, we weren't as savvy back then about these kinds of choices. What if we actually go back and try that again and see if those kinds of decisions still kind of holds up? Now, this is going to be really difficult because obviously nostalgia pangs, you know, and hangs really high on these games because we've, you know, these games have like a very emotional tone, specifically even the first one, right? I mean, it's very intense emotionally. So I wonder if there's a way for us to even play that with like a blank slate and like, and see if, you know, if we'll have the same reaction or if we'll just basically say that all the choices are rudimentary as well. Because I have a feeling that what's going to happen is exactly what you just said. Like, for example, like, oh yeah, well, you know, you want this guy to survive, but they're going to die eventually later anyway, you know, that sort of situation. Because I feel like those things do happen in the first Walking Dead. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, they do. But again, my argument is that even though the illusion is something that you can see through in the first game as well, the fact remains that the first game is better written, for sure. And two, those decisions still feel in that moment like they matter.
Right.
While a lot of the, like, not all of them, but a lot of the decisions in season three feel arbitrary.
I see. Okay. Wow. We talked a lot about a game that you don't care about. I feel really bad.
Fuck that game.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, on the flip side, though, I've been enjoying video games again. I mean, it's funny because, like, last week I told you, like, hey, man, I didn't play a lot of video games and stuff. And then, of course, you know, I did play Battle Chef Brigade, which I promptly put down, by the way. So I have not actually picked up the game since the last time we talked about it. Instead, I've actually been reveling on two games lately. You'd be really surprised what they are, but ooh, probably not. Street Fighter V just came out with the Arcade Edition update this week. And, you know, before I continue with my second game, I want to say for all those haters who said, like, oh, well, they're just going to release a Super Street Fighter V. You know, it's not like what they said, that it, everything's going to be, like, free. Fuck that. Because it just happened. Arcade Edition is a major update that actually adds not one arcade mode, but six arcade modes in Street Fighter V. Now, I don't, what is your history with fighting games, Daniel? That, I feel like that's something that I never asked you.
I suck at fighting games.
Okay.
I haven't really played that much, but I'll try to go through as much of my history with them as I can. So, I've played Super Street Fighter 2, like everyone on the Super Nintendo. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking it was pretty cool.
Right.
Let's see. I've also played some Mortal Kombat.
Okay.
I remember loving the movie as a kid. I don't know how I'd feel about it now, but I remember I loved that movie as a kid.
It's good, cheesy fun, man.
Now, I also really enjoyed King of Fighters 95 on the PS1. That was a good game.
So, okay, so you played fighting games, but not necessarily trying to be a pro. So you're more like a casual fan and stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah, okay. I'd say so. Like, I also played Super Smash Brothers. I got into Soul Calibur's 2, 3, and 4.
Okay.
And I'd say the only fighting game I played that I got, like, even remotely decent at would probably be Blaze Blue Calamity Trigger. That was one I got into.
Yeah, that thing has so many mechanics. That's pretty insane.
Yeah, I played that one a good bit, and I enjoyed that one a lot. And, yeah. So, I'm not like super into fighting games. I think that the skill ceiling for fighting games is so ridiculously high that I feel like I need to become like a monk in the mountains just to train in order to play these games properly.
Right, right. You know, the funny thing is that that's what people thought of fighting games and still do, like apparently from what you're saying. But the odd thing about this is that Street Fighter V actually is probably the most accessible Street Fighter they've ever made, even more so than 4, since Part 2. It really is that accessible. Like, you can literally use the same strategies that you were using in Street Fighter 2 and maybe add a few more. You know, like, it doesn't expect you to be like a huge, like, you know, like fighting game dude, which obviously you could if you wanted to, depending on your time. But it's like a quick game that I can pop in and play with, you know, a friend or something like that and have a lot of fun. You know, the reason why I am asking is because Street Fighter V, you know, is a very, very different fighting game than most of its kind, because the way that they build Street Fighter V is it's not just a game, but it's a platform, you know. And this is great, actually, because 2 years, you know, running now, we're almost to 2 years of Street Fighter V, by the way. A lot of people who were casuals, like, just didn't like it. Like, they didn't like the fact that there was no arcade mode in the original game. It was just purely like an online, you know, like versus mode kind of situation where you're just kind of trying to get better and stuff, which is totally fine if you play it that way. But for me, like, what really completed the package is the fight with the AI, the endings at the end, right? Like, you know, getting that sweet, sweet ending after defeating Bison at the highest difficulty level or Akuma or anything like that. And that was still missing for the past 2 years. And for a time, Capcom was really super quiet. Until, of course, last month when they announced Arcade Edition, where they literally said, hey, by the way, we're not just giving you Street Fighter V Arcade Edition, but we're also giving you what basically amounts to a carbon copy of every single Street Fighter single player arcade mode from Street Fighter 1 all the way to Street Fighter 5. And the fact that I see no reaction from you means you just totally did not give a shit for that. Okay, great. Awesome. Fantastic.
I mean, I've actually played Street Fighter V a little bit, not too much. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of like, oh, it's Street Fighter.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly is Street Fighter.
Okay. So not caring about, like, so it doesn't seem strike me that you're interested mechanically in some of the newer characters as well. Like, really not.
I mean, Jury's pretty fucking hot.
I mean, Jury's been around since 4.
I know. I'm just saying.
So, I mean, and that's kind of like the thing. It's like, you know, I guess the reason why I like it so much is because it wasn't as impenetrable as 4. Because 4 was actually the Street Fighter where they said, yeah, Street Fighter's back. It plays like 2. And then they add the focus attack dash cancel bullshit, which is basically just pressing 2 buttons, and when an impact hits, you dash forward, which, man, I don't even know how you fucking do that on a controller, because that kind of movement is exactly what you said when you were talking about, like, oh, you need to be, like, super pro and super fast reaction time. Whereas Street Fighter V is literally, like, you know, all about the strategy, because it's deliberately slower paced than most Street Fighters. And a lot of people, of course, hated that initially, but, you know, it is what it is. But I've enjoyed it. I was playing a friend earlier today before this podcast, and he was trying out Sakura, who is part of the 3rd season of characters in Street Fighter V. And I do have to stress this. If you already have a copy of Street Fighter V, you do not have to buy the arcade edition. You just need to download the update. Period. And all the fight money that you earned before carries over. Now, have you heard of anything about the fight money in this game, Daniel?
Basically, you earn fight money through battles, and you can use it to purchase characters and stages and stuff like that.
Yeah, pretty much. That's still in effect But now they have like different challenges that you can undertake, which are pretty simple. Like land three special moves on an opponent. Doesn't matter if you're playing with a friend. I actually got that. Win a round online. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, how you do it. I got that. So it's very friendly when it comes to trying to reward you with activities this time, because before there was some fight money that were gated behind different challenges, and some people just can't finish them. So they're trying to just encourage like more constant play with these challenges, which I think is actually a better idea. So, but I can tell you this, like the presentation of Street Fighter V is drastically different than what it was 2 years ago. Arcade edition is really fantastic. And like I said, like the game has six arcade modes, like Street Fighter 1, Street Fighter 2, Alpha, Street Fighter 3, Street Fighter 4, and Street Fighter 5, and appropriate characters for each game. So, for example, if you wanted to play Street Fighter 2 with Juri, not possible. She was never in Street Fighter 2, and you won't be able to play her, you know?
Boo.
Yeah, so those are the kinds of situations. But you can play her against her in Street Fighter 4, because, you know, she is in there, you know? So it tries to mimic that sort of gameplay. But also, if you finish a character, you know, like in that arcade mode, you know, they might have a different ending in Street Fighter 2 than they do in 3 or 4 or 5, you know? Like, so it's interesting because they do have different endings per game if they're present there as well. So it kind of continues that story. So while it took them about 2 years to get to this point, I'm pretty damn happy it's a free fucking upgrade, because now everybody who's had Street Fighter 5 can benefit from this update. So
okay, but I have an extremely important question.
Okay.
Is it crossplay with the Steam version?
It always has been.
Awesome. I'll pick up the Steam version then. And then you and I can duke it out. How's that sound?
Okay. Yeah, it's, you know, even if you buy the regular Street, here's the tough part, right? I know that you could buy the Steam version, but that Steam version of the original Street Fighter 4 is long gone. They're probably going to sell you the arcade edition, which is basically
whole
kit and caboodle, which is, again, $60. But you do get the first and second seasons of characters, which is, you know, the plus for it. You need to buy a season pass for season 3. That being said, if you want to play it that way, you're more than welcome to do so. As far as the game goes, you have to sign up for an account in the game itself to get like a what they call the Capcom Fighters Network account, and that's actually what allows you to play against people cross-platform. And mind you, this is a PS4 to PC, you know, kind of situation here, or, you know, vice versa or whatever situation. So I think it's really cool. It's really freaking cool how they have this set up. So it's one of the few cross-platform games on PS4. So good stuff. The other game that I've been playing is, because the esports side of this has been kind of ramping up a lot. It actually started last week, midweek of Wednesday, and continues on its second week as of this recording, is Overwatch. And I've told you about Overwatch plenty of times before. Have you actually looked into it since the last time we talked?
No.
God damn it, man. And the funny thing, too, is like that they do have free weekends from time to time. And I actually had spent, I want to say, 2 hours today playing with that same friend in Overwatch. So literally, like, we just said, okay, we're done with Street Fighter V. Let's switch over to Overwatch. You know, the conveniences of console, by the way, like on the voice chat. And so, you know, we were kind of rusty and stuff. Like, it's okay. First of all, I've been talking a lot. Do you have anything on your mind that you want to talk about?
Well, I did see an anime recently called Devilman. I only saw like the first 2 episodes of it. Do you mind if I talk about it for a little bit?
Are you talking about the Netflix one? It kind of looked like crap.
Yes, I'm talking about the Netflix one, and fuck you, it's not crap.
It didn't look anime enough, man. It looked like an American like animated it.
Okay, that's because of the director, Masaaki Yuasa. That he has a very specific visual style where he uses very simple designs and colors in order to create a more fluid-looking animation.
Okay, it still looks American to me.
Well, it's not. The director's name is Masaaki Yuasa, okay? He's not American.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Just keep thinking that. No, just kidding.
Well, the reason I wanted to check it out was, for one, Devilman is a manga that was created by Gō Nagai, who is extremely influential in the world of manga and anime. Devilman is, in fact, one of the primary inspirations for Berserk. And he's also one of the first people, I think, that created the Maho Shoujo genre, which is basically what Sailor Moon is. So, yeah, he single-handedly created the genre that Sailor Moon was in. So this guy's pretty important, and I never got around to reading the Devilman manga. Mm-hmm. But when I heard that there was going to be a new anime and it was directed by Masaaki Yuasa, I immediately went, yeah, I want to watch that. Now, I've only ever seen one other series by Yuasa, and that is the Tatami Galaxy, which is a show that I highly recommend. It is really great. See, it's a show that's about this guy that is in college. Shocker, an anime that is not in high school, but in fact college.
Wow, what a change.
I mean, you say that, but I mean, do you know how many high school anime there are?
I mean, I know that there's a ton.
Yeah, there's a fucking fuck ton. But the Tatami Galaxy is really good. So it's very mature. It's also kind of goofy and weird. There's like this one part where this guy, it's amazing. He's like talking. He's like singing a song about how he wants to be like a circle. It's fucking weird, but it's great. But going back to Devilman, I only saw the first two episodes, so I can't like give it like a full recommendation yet or anything. Mm-hmm. But I did like what I saw. Some aspects of it seemed a little weird. Like, it felt like some things didn't get fully explained, and I'm kind of assuming that maybe some things were left out of the manga. So after I finished watching the series, I'm thinking I should check out the manga. Apparently the manga is only like 5 volumes, which is not that long. So I'm thinking of maybe going back to the source material, just kind of like compare and contrast. But if one of the things that really stuck out to me watching it was the pacing and the blocking and the directing was all like on a theatrical level. Like, it didn't feel like I was watching a show or a series. It felt like I was watching a movie that just so happened to be the length of a TV series.
Okay.
I thought it was really interesting, and I think that, I know you're like, oh, it doesn't look anime enough. I give it a shot. It's only 10 episodes, you know.
It's a hard sell. It's a hard sell for me, especially like since I have to convince one other person in the household to watch it, and she actually is the one that pointed out that it wasn't anime enough. So, yeah, good luck with that.
Okay, I mean, you're lost, but
I guess so.
I mean, the first two episodes I saw, I thought were really good. The main character, he seemed a little annoying at first in the first episode, but then by the end of the first episode, is it a spoiler? I guess it kind of is. It
probably is.
So I guess I won't say. Let's just say, you know, shit goes down, and the final scene in the first episode is like a big, like, yo, what the fuck moment that changes him. And that's all I'll say.
Okay, well, since we're on the topic of what we've watched somehow, we went from, like, the opposite direction of when we usually start the podcast on non-video game-related stuff, you know, and then into video game-related stuff. We're kind of doing the it's, like, opposite day-to-day for some reason. I actually had introduced my girlfriend to Once Upon a Time in Mexico because I did not know that she'd never seen that movie.
Interesting. I don't know if I mentioned it before, but like I remember seeing that in the theaters and yes. I was kind of mixed on it.
Yeah. So watching it again, because I haven't seen it in years and stuff, I just really appreciated how batshit insane crazy that movie is. And I feel like, you know, I told her the way that I framed it is that it's kind of a guilty pleasure. It's not. It actually, I think the guy is actually pretty smart. Robert Rodriguez, I'm talking about, by the way. I think the guy is a genius in his own way. Obviously, I can't say that I am a huge fan of all his work. Spy Kid comes to mind. But as far as the El Mariachi trilogy, man, that's amazing. Especially the first one where he only spent $7,000 and it earned $2 million. How can you do that these days, you know? Like
I'd like that kind of turnaround.
Right? Yeah, I want to see that on the freaking podcast. What the hell? Remember to go to bit.ly/AmazonBacklogBattle and make our $2 million dream come true, please.
Please, we're begging you.
Yeah. But anyways, I told her, like, yeah, this is by Robert Rodriguez. She's like, do I need to know who this person is? And I'm like, no, it's, you know, it's this really cool dude. Like, he basically, you know, still kind of feel, you know, like, I feel like he's a really good director who has this kind of 90s feel to, like, his action movies and stuff. And
he's still working.
He's still working. And we got to the part of Once Upon a Time in Mexico that I feel like it really set the stage for her expectations. If you remember, there was a scene where Salma Hayek and Antonio Banderas were chained together, and they were basically literally platforming outside of their hotel room as they're being shot at, you know, like out of the hotel bedroom. Do you remember that scene? Probably not.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, but like, dude, I saw that movie in theaters. So
oh my God. It's really insane. It's really fun because it's so ridiculous that you can't help but be like, okay, yeah, now it's time to suspend disbelief. That's why the name of the movie is Once Upon a Time in Mexico, is because it's like a fantasy western. And that's kind of, I feel like that's actually a very accurate representation of that movie. It is a fantasy western in its own way. And I actually still really enjoy it after seeing that movie, by the way. So I guess there's that.
Cool. I mean, I might have to rewatch it, but then again, I think I'd rather rewatch Desperado instead.
It's a very different, two very different movies, because Desperado is very much pure action rated R stuff, whereas, you know, like I said, like I feel like Once Upon a Time in Mexico harkens back to a different kind of western, you know, like. Do you consider these as westerns, by the way, or just action movies?
I've never really thought about it. I mean, that's an interesting question. I'm not really sure.
Because categorically, they are westerns.
Okay, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either until I actually looked it up, and, you know, not recently, of course, but this was like a long time ago, and people said, like, yeah, they're westerns. I'm like, what? Like, how are they western? I guess because, you know, the guy has spurs and the guitar, I guess, and it's in Mexico, maybe. I don't know. I don't know the criteria of westerns are, but speaking
what, of... You know, one thing that kind of bothered me, now I'm remembering the movie, was like, Danny Trejo was walking around like asking for El Mariachi, Antonio Banderas's character, and he's like, ¿Dónde estás El Mariachi? And people be like, I don't know, which one? There's a bunch of mariachis. He needs like El. Like,
I thought that was funny. I thought that was hilarious because he literally said El Mariachi, and of course, like, what else? What else? Like, the dude does not have a name. Like, what else do you? What else can you do?
That's what, yeah, I never noticed that in the first Desperado that we don't even hear what his name is.
Yeah, even in the original El Mariachi, you don't even hear his name. At least I don't think so. But in Desperado, I can tell you, yeah, we didn't hear his name.
I never saw the original Mariachi, and I actually own it on Blu-ray. I just haven't watched it.
I see. So, but yeah, I it is a western in some ways, I think. I think the whole idea of it being a western is that, hey, you know, like there are tropes that, you know, western movies have, and these movies just happen to have. A good example is actually Sergio Leone would reuse and recast the same actors, but in different roles in each of the movies. So, for example, Cheech Marin has a different role in Desperado as he does in, you know, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. So
I heard he got sued over A Fistful of Dollars because it was kind of like a loose remake of Yojimbo.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Like,
I mean, I've seen both movies, and I could tell you for a fact that, yes, Fistful of Dollars is a pretty nearly blatant ripoff of Yojimbo. Like, but I think it was intentional.
I mean,
I think he wanted it to be like a Western version of it, but I didn't know he didn't get permission.
I mean, to be quite honest, a lot of the Westerns do borrow from Akira Kurosawa sometimes. You know, like a good example is Seven Samurai. They have the Magnificent Seven in the States.
Yeah, but I think that was like very specifically intentioned to be a Western adaptation of Seven Samurai.
Right. And that's the other question, right? Is Seven Samurai a Western?
No, it's a samurai movie. No, it's a samurai movie. That's it.
Man, okay. All right, yeah.
Did you know Seven Samurai is actually my favorite movie of all time?
Whoa, that's pretty tall, especially of how fucking boring that movie is sometimes.
Fuck Holy you! Fuck you! No!
There are parts of that movie that don't hold up the test of time. At least I will say
I strongly disagree. No. No.
I mean, you know, you could say that all you want, but, you know, like, you'll just be like, okay, I think he's right. Like, when you
watch No, I'm not. That movie's a fucking masterpiece. I will have none of it. I'll have none of your bullshit.
That's funny. Okay, so before you went into your tirade about Devilman, and of course I went on a tirade on Once Upon a Time in Mexico, I do want to kind of go back to Overwatch, because the Overwatch League is going on. And for the people who are players of Overwatch, if you actually tie your Blizzard account with Twitch and watch an Overwatch League game, you actually gain points to use in Overwatch to buy, you know, like uniforms and costumes for your favorite team, which have,
so it latches over.
I see what you did there. It does carry over to your games and stuff. So I don't know how that works necessarily, because first of all, I have two copies of Overwatch. Does it put the points on both? If that's the case, that's pretty fucking sweet. But
I mean, that would be convenient. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like where I'm coming from with this. I'm like, I have two copies of Overwatch. I have the PC version and I have the PS4 version. And honestly, I play more of the PC PS2 version than I do the PC. So send it over
the PS2
way.
Version.
Oh, PS4. I'm sorry. That would be cool if it was, you know, a what? PS2 version.
I want to. That's it, Blizzard. Make it happen. PS2 version of Overwatch. Yeah, do it.
Yeah, PS2 demake, please. That's gonna be great.
I would I would play that just to see what it would look like.
I mean, who wouldn't? But yeah, like I do play the PS4 version a lot, and you know, it's crazy. And I'll say this. It's so much fun to just be able to pick up that game and play it. And because, like, we actually start off playing against the AI because we're so rusty. But the gameplay, the shooting just feels so good, even on a controller, that I'm like, I just, you know, like, my friend and I just kind of got used to it, like, immediately. Like, I was doing headshots and stuff and, you know, doing some really crazy stuff, you know. And it's very much like a fighting game, which is why, like, you know, we transitioned from Street Fighter V to Overwatch, because it does have, you know, the kinds of gameplay that you would in a fighting game. But I think, personally, I think that Overwatch is a lot more accessible to most people, because even though you use the same terminology and the same ideas, I think working with a group is a lot more conducive to learning those ideas. Does that make sense? Like, poking and territorial, like, you know, conflict, that sort of situation.
Yeah, I kind of what you're saying. I mean, but Overwatch, though, I mean, how would you say, like, someone who, you know, how would you kind of sell someone on the game? Because I technically own it, and I fiddle around with it a little bit, and I was just kind of like, eh, and bounced off it. So I want to ask, like, what would you say to someone like me who's kind of like a little wishy-washy towards it? How would you sell it?
That's difficult, because I'm the kind of guy that this wasn't marketed, that I guess this wasn't marketed to me, I think. And the reason why I say that is because I'm not a competitive gamer at all. Like, I've mentioned it many times on the show in the entire years, and even, like, in the past, you know, archives on my backlog battle.tv of all the podcasts I've ever done, I've never, ever a competitive player. In fact, the fact that when I even picked up Street Fighter V, that's a rarity that I actually picked up a fighting game. Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite, by the way, have not touched that since I got it. That's kind of what tells you how much of a competitive gamer I am. Very specific games do attract me to play them, right?
Yeah, and I was going to say, similarly, I'm not really all that competitive either. That's why I play so many single-player games, because I'm all about, you know, going on adventures and shit, and or seeing a story unfold, or really getting into a game's mechanics. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, in a competitive game, you could argue, like, oh, that's mechanic-based as well. But at the same time, there's, like, a different kind of pressure to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in a way that's not there in a single-player game.
So there is a very specific reason why I play a lot of PS4 Overwatch as opposed to PC. I'm getting old. There's no way in hell that my reflexes are going to get better over time. It's only going to get worse, okay? You play in a PC if you still have that kind of reaction time. Now, granted, you know, my girlfriend does play Overwatch and stuff, and more power to her. I think she's actually really good at it. But I can't see myself moving that fast. Does that make sense? Like, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say here is that you get the same experience on both platforms to a degree, right? But there are different limitations to both. For me, at least my opinion, the limitations you have on PC is basically your physical ability.
Yeah, you know, grandpa.
Yeah. That being said, though, I don't. If I do, you know, play Overwatch on PC, push comes to shove, I don't need to actually play characters that are super fast or, you know, are really easy to, you know, to get a kill for, right? Like, or rather, I'm phrasing it wrong. I don't have to be playing precise characters when it comes to aiming. Does that make sense? Like,
I was going to ask, though, couldn't you theoretically play the PC version of Overwatch with a controller?
Ah, but there's no auto aim. Because remember that the PS4 version, you cannot play that with a mouse and keyboard. A lot of people say, like, you should put it. And I'm like, yeah, but it's going to imbalance the freaking game. It's tuned for controller players, right?
Tuned for lean?
Yeah. What's that?
No, I was just remembering this old thing where one of the Call of Duty games didn't have lean in it. Like, you couldn't lean to peek around a corner. And right. The reason they did it was because they didn't tune the game for lean. And it's just this funny this funny thing.
I see. I think I get what you're coming from.
It just sounds like a ridiculous thing to me. It's like, oh, the game is tuned for lean.
I mean, believe it or not, like, you know, the design of first-person shooters is very complex.
I didn't mean to imply otherwise. I just thought that specifically was funny and dumb.
Well, either way, like, the whole design of first-person shooters is kind of interesting to me because, you know, when Blizzard was actually designing Overwatch, they actually went into other first-person shooters and actually literally measured, like, the spawn point locations to the actual encounter points where most fights would happen. And they found out that there was a general average or a general expectation as to when those fights happen. And so, you know, so it's not just making a map, like, as what most people might think, but it's a lot of measuring and you know, and of course tuning and stuff. But yes, I get the joke. Going back to what I was saying though, and I know this is kind of getting a little bit long-winded, the way that I see Overwatch, it's kind of like
it was tuned for lean.
No. It's kind of like playing with action figures. Because, I mean, and actually this is an example Blizzard has said too. There is a story to Overwatch. You can watch all that outside of the game. But if you want to play with the action figures themselves, you have to play the game, right? And it's kind of a weird thing, but like I kind of like all, you know, like the powers of some of the characters. And I actually like being those characters and playing as those characters. And also to the point where you said like you like being, you know, a single player gamer. I think the most interesting part to me over that's happened over the past couple of years is how I started gravitating towards support characters. And, you know, specifically starting with Final Fantasy 14 and then realizing and applying that principle to other games, like, for example, Overwatch. So I'm not the guy who's killing a whole bunch of people in the game. I'm the guy that's basically going to revive you from the dead or actually heal you all the way up to max level. So that's my job in the game. And because of the way that Overwatch is tuned, I can totally focus on that if I wanted to.
For lean.
You know? So it's not just a shooter. You can think of it as a shooter all you want. But if you start thinking about each of the characters and what their role is, their general role is in the meta, if you will, of the game, you know, it's more than just shooting. It's setting traps. It's kind of outmaneuvering enemies and stuff. And it, in a way, it's almost like playing a strategy game, but you're also playing it with other people in real time. That makes sense?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely don't feel that I gave it like a proper fair shake. Mm-hmm. I only messed around with it for a little bit and then I just, you know, stopped.
Yeah.
So one of these days I will hunker down and be like, all right, Overwatch, let's do it. Let's fucking do it. Yeah. And I'll give it a fair shake.
Yeah. If anything, like, how about this? Like, how about you try to watch like one of the Overwatch League games? I mean, that sounds really ridiculous considering how you're not really invested in the game to begin with. And I don't really foresee watching a professional game changing your opinion. But I think that what's kind of interesting, you know, with these kinds of games is that when you watch the pros do it, you know, you never feel that you can't do it in the game because of the way that the game is structured. Because it is purely a team game, you can try to replicate those strategies just by working with your team. It's that simple. It's not like a fireball combo that you have to do in Street Fighter. It's not, you know, the spacing that you have to basically, you know, manage or anything like that. It's on a more grander and easier to understand scale. And that's why, you know, I made the comparison between Street Fighter V and Overwatch, because you do poke, you do take spaces away from other people and stuff, and you do control space. The question is, how do you do it? You know, and in Overwatch, it's overt. You literally take that space. You know, whereas in Street Fighter, you throw a fireball or you jump kick in the air. You know, does that make sense to you?
So you're saying Street Fighter V was not tuned for lean.
Jesus Christ. You really want this to be the fucking title of the show, do you? No, that's why.
That wasn't the intention, but now that you say it.
Jesus Christ. Okay, fine. It's not tuned for lean. I get it. Okay. So, but yeah, like, I think you should watch it just to kind of see. It's happening right now, and by the time we finish the show, it'll, you know, they'll have like about two more shows. And you know, it's the way that I see it, though, to close this whole segment, it's something that I can actually, you know, like, have dinner with in a way and watch on TV while I'm eating dinner before I play my video games. It's kind of a neat thing to watch. So I think you should go check it out.
All right. Cool beans.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure you'll have dinner after this anyway. So,
yeah, man, I'm hungry.
I am too. Okay, so anyways, so now that we've taken care of all that biz-niche, let's move on to news, shall we?
You got it.
All right, for this news article, it reads, David Cage accused of fostering a toxic and inappropriate workplace at Quantic Dream. And Daniel, man, I am so happy that you're my co-host and realized how much you absolutely hate this guy, because here's an article.
Fuck him!
He's an article furthering your hate towards him. Is hate the most appropriate, like, you know, like word to describe your feelings towards David Koj?
To be fair, like, I don't hate him as an individual, or rather, maybe I will after I read this fucking article, but, I mean, I don't like him.
Okay, all right, I think that's fair. In a report by Le Monde, first reported and translated by Eurogamer, Quantic Dream and two of its executives, David Cage and Guillaume de Fondomier, are accused of creating an office environment rife with crunchy, I combined crunch and hugely. That's not what's
Nestle's crunch.
Like, imagine if it read like this: with crunchy inappropriate humor. Like, what? Like, doesn't make sense. Okay, what it really reads is: with crunch and hugely inappropriate humor, including racist and sexist jokes. Okay, that's pretty damn serious.
Oh God,
yeah, it's pretty serious. In all three reports from Le Monde, Canard PC, and Mediapart, there is mention of 600 Photoshopped images from as far back as 2013 that contain quote-unquote degrading images. Oh man, this is a spiral that's going down pretty fast.
This is getting heavy, dude.
Yeah. It says the most shocking images present Quantic Dream's collaborators in sexual positions adorned with homophobic or sexist slurs, or even made up to look like Nazis, reported the
Monde. What the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. It goes on. Cage and de Fondomier deny having known about the worst of these images, though there are reports that these Photoshopped images were displayed in public office spaces. In addition, Cage and de Fondomier have each been accused of their own individual contributions to Quantic Dream's hostile work environment. Now, here's the funny part, Daniel. Le Monde tries to spin a positive in this article. Let me read this part. Le Monde does point out that in an industry that has trouble with regards to labor laws and practices, that Quantic Dream is good with paying overtime along with dinner and taxi fares for employees who work into the evening, though a sales fee for quote-unquote loyal employees has proven controversial. That's the article.
Wow. Okay. There's a lot to unpack here. So yeah. I want to say first and foremost that, like, I think anyone who's worked in any sort of work environment can relate to the kind of raunchy humor that can go around. It's a way of blowing off steam. And I don't think that necessarily should incriminate people and make them out to be horrible individuals just because they have some raunchy sense of humor.
Agreed.
That being said, I haven't worked in the workforce for a while now. Not once have I ever, me or my coworkers, photoshopped us as Nazis, okay?
Yeah.
I've never done that. No one I know has ever done that. What the fuck is going on in Quantic Dream that this is where the humor has devolved to? That's like a whole other level of what the fuck.
That seems really, really bad and very damning, especially when they have a game coming out, you know? I mean, for people who missed it and stuff, this game, like Detroit Become Human, is actually one of my most anticipated games of 2018. Now, granted, I have funny feelings about associating, like a person's actions, like a person who's worked on a game or a movie or whatever, with that person's like political stance or their actions and stuff. Like, I can actually totally divorce myself from the person who's making it, right? But at the
death
same,
of the author,
right? But the thing is, it's like, I can't help but think, like, am I supporting this kind of behavior by buying Detroit Become Human? It becomes that kind of question, right? I mean, do you agree?
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from, because on one hand, you want to be able to assess the art, you know, divorced from whoever created it. But at the same time, you don't want your money to be going to a bad place. It kind of reminds me of when I found out that the mangaka for Rurouni Kenshin turned out to have spent a lot of his money on, unfortunately, I have to say it, like, pedophilic material. Oof. And it's really bad. And it, on one hand, it's not the art's fault that the creator that made it was a turd. But at the same time, you do have to realize that the money that you may have spent, you know, purchasing the manga or the anime went into something pretty nefarious. And I think it applies here where, you know, your money is going to these people that are, you know, of questionable worth. And I think that's something that a lot of people can't reconcile with.
Yeah, I agree. More recently and stuff, I mean, you know, like Netflix has pretty much effectively canceled like House of Cards. And, you know, Kevin Spacey just happens to be one of my favorite actors, you know, like, and the whole thing about him, you know, and all these, you know, news surrounding him and stuff made me like really sad because, you know, like, do I feel, am I supposed to feel bad for actually like patronizing and kind of supporting his work? Because I feel like he's a talented actor prior to these events and stuff. It becomes kind of like a huge issue. And the thing is that I'm kind of scared of is that I don't want the next few years, even, you know, even 2018 for that matter, to devolve to witch hunting people and figuring out whether they have wronged their fellow man for some reason. You know, because I feel like that's kind of like a weird situation. I mean, obviously, David Cage and Guillaume de Fondomiere, like all these allegations and stuff, I don't know where this is headed, right? These are all reports. I don't even know if there's legal action that's being, you know, pursued as far as this is concerned. But it is kind of disturbing to think that, you know, well, nobody's going to sit down and Photoshop 600 images, I hope not, right, of all this stuff. But that's still really crazy to me that, you know, it's gotten to this point and all of a sudden, like, we're only now hearing it, right? Like, it even said, like, some of these Photoshop images go as far back as 2013. I mean, my God, it's been 5 years. So the fact that somehow they've been really tight-lipped about this is almost making me want to question the allegations. But at the same time, what grounds do I have? You know, like, I'm over here, they're in France. It's like, I can only, like, speculate on my part.
I also thought that it bringing up the thing about Crunch was a little weird because, I mean, you and I, we've mentioned the book Blood, Sweat, and Pixels multiple times. And one of the things that's pretty consistent in that book, in pretty much almost all of the developer stories that goes on, is that each of them deals with Crunch. So it either they're bringing it up just because it's another stab at David Cage, or the amount of crunch that David Cage is imposing on his employees is to such a degree that it's abnormal even for the video game industry. So, and I'm not really sure, you know, what is the implication here.
Exactly, exactly. I'm kind of with you on this because more recently and stuff, like, you know, I re-listened to the part with, you know, CD Projekt Red in Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, and they talked about how overtime is actually paid in Poland as well. So, I mean, it seems like most European countries do pay for overtime, right? We don't really know that much information about how conditions are there, but of course, like in Poland, it's like, you know, from what I know at least of the interviews, like the cost of living is much, much lower. So, I mean, you're probably earning a buttload of money with all the overtime that you're getting anyway. But I feel like that's kind of the extent of our knowledge as far as that place is concerned, right?
Right. We can only speak on what goes on here. We don't have as intimate of a knowledge of what goes on in Europe.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So this next article, I kind of modified this from the original article because I think that there is a problem here, like specifically with Bungie. The article that I've kind of Frankenstein together now reads, Bungie tries to salve Destiny 2's wounds with broad strokes roadmap. In an attempt to head the worst of the PR off at the press, Bungie released a development roadmap this week, detailing their plans for new content and reworking of existing systems from here until late 2018. Now, before I continue here, Daniel, what have you heard about Destiny and Destiny 2? Like, I know you're kind of like just a passive or, you know, casual observer of goings on in Destiny. What do you think about all this stuff?
Yeah, I'm kind of out of the loop. It's kind of hard for me to really comment. I do know that fans of Destiny 2 in general have been kind of dissatisfied with the game, particularly in terms of like what Bungie has been doing with the loot boxes and stuff like that. So I don't know. I don't know how to really comment on this. It's not really my forte.
Okay. Well, I'll try to give you as much context with this article as I can, okay? Okay. So,
all right. Sounds good.
Okay. So the development roadmap actually has this note by game director Christopher Barrett. It says, "Hey, everyone, at the end of this year, I made a promise that I would update you on our plans for Destiny 2. The team has been hard at work, and we're ready to share where we're headed. We used to wait to talk about game updates until we were certain we could meet our deadlines to avoid letting players down if we changed our plans. No longer. We're not just listening, we are doing." Naturally, what happens here is that instead of actually being very concrete about like their goals and some of the kinds of changes that they're going to do, or the ideas that they have, mind you, the roadmap has very broad strokes of information. Like, let's say we're going to fix this aspect of it, we're going to do that. So it's not really going into detail like what the community might want to read in order to keep invested in the game or keep their faith in the game, so to speak. Here's the kind of final paragraph by the author of this article. It says, "Destiny 2's patchy content release schedule and the worrying brevity of the Curse of Osiris expansion made me realize just how spoiled I've been by the semi-episodic expansion structure of Guild Wars 2 and Final Fantasy 14. Both games receive massive paid expansions every now and then, but fill the intervening time with free, in this case of a Guild Wars 2, or standard with subscription, Final Fantasy 14, episodic updates, each easily equivalent to the size of a Destiny 1 or 2 expansion. If Bungie wants to play with the big kids in the MMO playground, they're gonna have to step up their game." So does this kind of give you a clarity of like what's going on with Destiny 2 right now and kind of like where the state it's been?
I mean, I do know you're a big fan of like Final Fantasy 14, so and based on what the little I've played of that as well, I can tell that there's a lot of care and consideration with the amount of content that's put in that game. So I would have to agree with the article where they're saying that, like, at least based on like what I've observed, that Bungie probably do need to step up their game if they want to play with the big boys. Because I mean, if you've got people that are clamoring for more and constantly coming back to Final Fantasy 14 because they're always so accommodating, they're always like having all these big expansions, they're always patching the game, they're adding new content constantly, and Destiny 2 fans don't feel that they're getting accommodated to nearly the same degree, then yeah, it kind of makes you question like, Bungie, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of their kind of pivoting involves around working around their monetization practices, which, you know, as you know, they have like a loot box like system where you can buy the loot boxes or you could just, you know, keep playing them. They've been broken before, especially for the events and stuff, where the last Christmas event that they did in Destiny 2, you probably would have to spend a ton of money in order to unlock everything, because even if you use the gameplay of the game, you can't actually unlock all those things in one go. Like in the entire...
Oh, that's bullshit.
Yeah, in the entire duration. Whereas in Final Fantasy 14, because it's subscription, they can afford to actually like build up the a quest line for it, like a new quest line every year, by the way, not a recycled one. New rewards, right? And, you know, the way that they do it is actually pretty elegant, because if you missed last year's event, for example, you know, if you're a new subscriber, you can just come back the following year, basically, and then essentially, like, you know, buy the game or buy those items that you've missed for those events on a cash shop. You know, because naturally, because if you think about it, I think that's fair, right? Like, if you miss, like, a subscription date for, you know, for an event, like let's say a Christmas event and stuff, I mean, it's pretty good to just be able to buy it, right? I think that's fair.
Yeah, I'd agree with you.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of like the missing piece here, is that Destiny 2 doesn't have a consistent flow of money. And I think actually, and this will probably sound like really controversial for a lot of people, I think that Destiny 2 or the Destiny series in general would actually be better served if it would if it had a monthly subscription. You know, like if there's always influx of money, I'm pretty sure they could do a ton more when they're able to, you know, make content. So people will actually, you know, be wanting to maybe spend more time with the game, working out the kinks and stuff. But as it stands, it's like this loot box system is just so egregious that, you know, it's not as bad as Battlefront 2 per se, but it's still pretty bad, you know, considering like the previous system in Destiny didn't charge for cosmetic items. Now it's like, well, it's now an RNG-based system where, you know, like it's luck of the draw kind of situation. So, because like, here's how I would explain this, okay? If you want to recolor armor in Destiny 1, you just use the shader and you still had that shader permanently. So you can keep recoloring your items permanently. Whereas in Destiny 2, shaders, the recoloring things, are consumables, right? So if you use one of those, it's gone forever. Even if it's a super duper rare one, it's gone forever. So you see where the ire is coming from, right? Like there's really no way around it.
Now you brought up Bungie possibly doing a subscription service, but I have to ask, do you think Bungie has even, do you think they've used up all their goodwill at this point? Do you think they could even manage to pull that off? And even if they do it, do you think people that would even want to do it? Because I don't know. I think that they've kind of pissed off enough people where if they tried to do something like that, even with good intentions, and it might work out for the better, I think a lot of people would just see it as this weird power play of just trying to get, you know, scrounge even more money out of us. I mean, I don't know. That's just an outsider looking in, but that's kind of how it would come across to me if they did something like that.
But that's the right attitude to have, though. Like, if you're not happy with the game, don't play it. Don't even support it. Don't even buy the expansions for it, right? I think that's the right attitude to have. Unfortunately, it's the only game of this kind around. So where are you going to go? You know, like Overwatch is not the same game. It's not an epic sci-fi shooter set in huge, expansive environments, you know, like, and you can't actually make the argument that the Division is one of them because the Division is a very different game than that, right? Also, Borderlands as well. You can't make the argument for Borderlands as well because it's not as epic, if you will. So it's really, the people who want to play Destiny are kind of stuck with Destiny 2. Now, the big question is, are people going back to Destiny 1? Because Destiny 1 is a fully feature-rich and complete game, right? And actually, a lot of people who basically like said, like, hey, if you enjoyed Destiny 2's gameplay, you should just go back to 1. And frankly, that's actually the kind of stance that I've taken ever since this news kind of came out, is that, hey, you should just go back to Destiny 1 and play it. It's a complete game. You know, I think a lot of people are tired that they have to wait 3 or 4 more years in addition to what they've had to deal with in Destiny 1 to get a Destiny 2 experience that is worth the wait. And honestly, like, you know, more power to them if they want to stick it out. But the only way to enact change is to basically like tell them, you know, tell the companies, like tell Bungie that you're sick and tired of this, is to not play their game and, you know, and just kind of like stick it out, you know. So,
not to mention Destiny 1, probably a cheaper game too.
Yeah, especially with even with all the expansions, more than likely, actually. Okay, Daniel, you're not going to believe this next news article. It literally came out just as when we were about to record this podcast. Are you you know what I'm talking about, right? Like,
unfortunately, yes, I do know what you're talking about.
Yes. So, okay, so for the people who don't know what we're talking about, the article reads, Nintendo announces Nintendo Labo, a wild new experiment for the Switch. Oh boy, here we go, guys. Nintendo today announced Nintendo Labo, a wild new experiment for the Switch that will allow players to insert the console into assorted pieces of cardboard, creating items like robots, fishing rods, and foot pedals. Nintendo Labo combines the magic of Nintendo Switch with the fun of DIY creations, the company explains on the Labo website. You'll start with a piece of cardboard, which you can use to build one of these items, and then you'll put the Switch in to power it up. Then, you'll be able to play games with your creations. Nintendo Labo will be out on April 20th. 420, you get that? Yeah. The company said. You'll be able to buy two different sets, the Variety Kit for $70 and the Robot Kit for $80. And Nintendo is calling them both Toy Cons because, of course. There you go. Nintendo is taking the whole level. I guess we're bringing the Switch to the next level of gaming, which I guess is cardboards, Daniel.
Yes, the next level is fucking cardboard.
Yeah, this is unbelievable to me because I thought, I mean, first of all, I'm surprised like the first thing out of your mouth was not the fact that they are charging $70 to $80 for cardboard.
I know! What the fuck? Yeah. What the fuck? That is so much money. And you, here's the thing. It's so much money and you have to build it yourself.
Exactly. I don't even know about this. I mean, I guess, what are they trying to do, to be quite honest? I'm kind of confused by this. Like, can you make a zapper gun out of this? Can you rebuild Rob the Robot with this? Because if you can't, I'd be really, really disappointed at this point.
You can play the piano, apparently.
Oh, God. Why? Like, and how well would that even move? I mean, granted, like, you know, when I was growing up and stuff, I used to grab, like, my grand aunt's, like, cigarette, like, cartons and stuff and make something out of it. But this is not that thing. This is not the same fucking thing. You are shoving a Joy-Con or the Nintendo Switch screen onto cardboard peripherals to play with them. I mean, I don't even know what to think right now, because it's like, there is potential, but at the same time, I can't help but think that they're charging almost close to $100 for a cardboard accessory. That's almost as ridiculous as Google Cardboard, if you remember that atrocity.
Yes, I remember. But here's the thing, though. At least Google Cardboard, I mean, that was aimed at adults, wasn't it?
I mean, maybe. I guess so. I mean, it's supposed to be like a cardboard that would just hold your phone in front of your face, and it's basically turns it into like a VR headset, which to me is just kind of ridiculous. I mean, is this something that, you know, they're doing in reaction to a lot of people saying like, hey, the Nintendo Switch should go on in VR or something, because they could just basically make a cardboard headset, kind of like, you know, Google Cardboard. I didn't think it would go this route.
Here's the thing, though, with me mentioning that Google Cardboard was probably for adults, is that this is very specifically for children. And do you honestly think that kids are going to be able to, one, have the patience to put this shit together, and two, not destroy it? I mean, come on, parents are going to be throwing away nearly $100 worth in cardboard that their kids are going to mishandle and destroy.
Okay, let's maybe take a step back and try to be optimistic about this. What good can come out of this? Can you think of something, Daniel?
Cardboard swords, maybe?
I mean, you could kind of already do that with a Joy-Con. I guess my question is this, right? Like, it's cool. I think it's kind of cool that they're trying something new with their platform, because let's face it, nobody, like, no other platforms can do this, right? Like, Xbox One can do this, Xbox, you know, I mean, I'm not talking technologically, right? I'm not talking that way, because obviously they have the horse, you know, the Xbox One and the PS4 have the horsepower to be able to do something like this. But just the nature of how the Switch is built as a unit that plays video games, right? It is more conducive to things like this. But apart from vibration and, I don't know, I actually don't even know, like, how this would work in any other case. Like, yeah, you could build a robot. That's freaking great, right? But how are you going to make it walk? Vibrate the Joy-Con? You know what I mean? It's like, how does that even work?
I don't know. And based on the video, some of this cardboard looks kind of complicated too. Like they opened one of them up and you see like the inner workings and they look like there was like rubber bands and stuff. And I was just like, what the hell?
Wow.
Like, what is this? Like, how does this actually work? Like, do they, and they, and again, do they actually expect children to put this stuff together on their own? Like, I guess they'll have their parents to help them too, but this also looks like really delicate stuff that kids are going to mishandle and, you know, they're not going to be able to take care of it properly, let alone know how to assemble it on their own.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jesus, $70 to $80, man. That's
fucking
already,
hell.
Yeah, that already shocks me. I'm like, holy crap. But you know, hey, you know, as with most things here on the Backlog Battle Podcast, I guess we'll wait and see what actually happens with this. If this is just like a test, that's totally fine. If you know this becomes the hottest toy like in the spring, maybe we'll eat our words. Who the hell knows? But as of right now, it is really difficult to see the practical applications of cardboard with the Switch. I think we can both agree on that, right?
Yeah. And I just gotta say, like, I think I'd be less harsh towards this if it wasn't so expensive.
It's cardboard.
I mean, if it was like $10 or something, then I'd be like, okay, you know, sure, why not? It's, you know, they put some work into it, you know, it's, yeah, sure, it's cardboard, but they did have to make sure that it, you know, they aligned it properly so that, you know, you can actually put the thing together. But this is just way too much for fucking cardboard. No,
yeah.
Just no, bad Nintendo, bad.
Yeah, totally. Oh my gosh. All right, well, that takes care of the news. Let's move on to community question, because I know we're kind of doing things a little bit backwards. Like, we usually do community question and then news, but we're going to actually end the show with the community question. And instead of actually reading the responses, because I realized when we're doing the show and preparing for the show that the responses would take forever for just two, you know, or even one. I just figured I'd just ask you this question.
Okay.
I don't know how fast you'll be able to answer this question, but yeah, this is pretty, this might lead into some interesting conversation. So the question of the week, the community question for the week, asks us what your favorite games are for the platforms that you owned.
Oh, snap.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
Now, here's the thing. Even if you actually played it emulated, like, for example, Virtual Console, that still counts, okay? And for the purposes of this question, I did say this in the question, which, by the way, you guys should check out the community question before it's gone, you know, for this week, for that matter. Because I think we have a different one. We'll have a different one by the time this comes out. So you guys should check it out on youtube.com/mybacklogbattle. Go with your gut. So basically the first ever game that you come up with as you're going through the systems. Don't overthink it. Don't be like, oh, well, this comes out first. But, you know, just rapid fire. Go.
Okay, so Xbox 360, Tales of Vesperia. For the Wii U, Hyrule Warriors, the original Wii, Twilight Princess. For the PS1... Oh shit.
was Beyond coming out first.
Fuck you, no. Final Fantasy Tactics.
Okay.
For PS2, Tales of the Abyss. For PS3 God damn it.
You're struggling with this. Holy crap.
Yeah, Catherine?
Okay.
Fuck it, Catherine.
Okay.
PS4... actually, no way. I take it back for PS3. It's not Catherine, it's Dark Souls.
Okay.
Okay, and for PS4, it's Bloodborne.
Okay. But your vote of Catherine is duly noted.
It is an honorable mention.
Okay.
So let's see what else. The GameCube is going to be Paper Mario and the Thousand Year Door. The N64 is going to be the first Paper Mario. Hey, Paper Mario is really fucking good.
Mm-hmm.
Super Nintendo is Zelda and Link to the Past. The original NES is going to be Gargoyle's Quest 2.
Okay.
What else? The original Game Boy is Pokemon Yellow. And let's see, Game Boy Advance is going to be Metroid Zero Mission.
Okay.
The original DS is going to be Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow. The Nintendo 3DS is going to be... What is the 3DS? Shit. I don't think I've played a whole lot of 3DS games.
Hmm.
I guess I'll go with Fire Emblem Awakening. That's the only one that I can think of that I've beaten.
Okay.
All right. What am I missing? I think that's everything.
Let's call it everything. How about that?
Yeah. I'd say I'd ran the gamut there. Oh, yeah. PSP. East 7.
Okay. Cool. Sounds good. All right.
Yes, there we go.
That's great. So if you haven't answered this week's community question, which is, by the way, again, it's not this question anymore. It's something completely new. Go to youtube.com/mybacklogbattle and look for the playlist that says community question. Just scroll down and you'll see it. Or even like, you know, in the upload section and stuff, you'll notice it has like, would you say it's like an orangey kind of like strip, like on the thumbnail?
Citrusy,
yes. So just click on that. That's the latest one. And just put on your answers and we'll read it on the following week's show and stuff, as we have before. So I think that about does it for this episode. Do you want to talk about like what you're going to be up to on your channel and plug your wares, good sir?
Sure. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, it is at Shintai Reviews. Please come talk to me, you know, message me if you want to interact with me. I won't bite, I promise. As for the what's going to go on with the channel, I'm still working on that Tales of Zestiria review. That's a big project. I'm like multiple pages into the script, and yeah, that's going to be a doozy.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I want to release a video on Devil May Cry 3, and it's going to be a think piece about the rivalry between Dante and Virgil, and how it not only it works as a narrative tool, but it also works in relation to the gameplay, and how, because as a narrative tool, it actually is a driving force for the player to increase their skills.
Okay. Cool.
Yep. I think those are like the main things. I think I'm also going to probably record like an update video, like kind of detailing like the future of the channel, one of these days.
For sure. And of course, on the Backlog Battle channel, which is youtube.com/mybacklogbattle, you can check out the new episode, like a brand new series again. I know I've been making a lot of video series lately. It is called Travel Eorzea. It features Mordona, which is a really cool place, like in Final Fantasy 14. If you're, you know, a casual fan of Final Fantasy, or, you know, you're basically starting with Final Fantasy 14, I'd recommend checking those out. Those are spoiler free. It just kind of shows like how beautiful Final Fantasy 14 is. And I think you guys will really enjoy it. And of course, the clips. You guys have been seeing the clips as well for like all the news clips and stuff for, you know, the Backlog Battle podcast. You should go check it out. And of course, every Friday, we got a new episode of Community Question. So, it's all on youtube.com/mybacklogbattle. And you can talk to me as well on twitter.com/mybacklogbattle. Our Facebook page has been taken down. I basically took it down because I actually couldn't manage it myself anymore. As what Daniel said last week, we're only, you know, a couple of people. You know, we're not an empire.
We're just a couple of schlubs. You know, give us a break.
Exactly. We're just a couple of schlubs. We're trying our best. And it's sad that the Facebook page had to fall. But, a lot of you guys on Twitter anyway. So I think, you know, it's a lot better to, you know, talk about that that way. And of course, Discord, which is bit.ly/BBA Discord. So if you guys haven't gone onto our Discord, like you should go check it out. More so if you have like Street Fighter V and Overwatch, because we're probably going to play that game a lot over the next few weeks. So, and of course, again, just to reiterate, Shintai Reviews, youtube.com/Shintai Reviews and twitter.com/Shintai Reviews. You should go check them out. But anyways, until next week, guys, on behalf of Daniel, this is Alex saying take care, enjoy your week, and happy gaming. See ya.